The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. In the next few years, 15 to be exact, we can expect to add another billion people to the world's population. And never before has there been such an increase in so short a time. Eradicating hunger is the biggest and yet the most complex task that man has ever set for himself. Putting a man on the moon seems absolutely simple in comparison with it. And solving the world's food problem requires half the world's population must be educated and trained. It means that practically every element of government and society must be geared to whip the problem and to solve it before it literally causes the worldwide wars that people fear today. It is the biggest, most ominous, most singularly important problem facing mankind today, and yet it's the one problem fewer people seem to be aware of and realize than any other. Now, almost everyone is having a hand at predicting the news these days, from telling you 1967 is going to be a year of horrible strikes all over the world, right down to trying to tell you what the weather is going to be like or whether Mrs. Kennedy is going to be one of the best-dressed women for this year. But few people seem to realize the ominous, awesome proportions of the food problems of the world today. For example, recently, U.S. Senator George McGovern said that at the present rate of population growth, even the few islands of plenty, and the United States is described as one of them, will disappear, and the world will simply run out of food by 1985. That kind of world would be one in which peace would be impossible. The resulting instability, Senator George McGovern said, would be such that starving people would tear their governments apart. Now, Dr. Harrison Brown, who is Foreign Secretary of the National Academy of Sciences and professor at the California Institute of Technology, was asked, and I quoted his answers to these questions in a recent program, "Is the population explosion that is so much talked about raising serious dangers for the world?" He answered, "Very serious. It carries all the elements of catastrophe, famine, plague, and major wars. Even here in our own country, we're in for serious trouble." Now, when we realize what's happening right now in India and how the United States has been frantically sending much of its reserves of grain to stave off famine, and yet now, in the last 5 years, since that program began in 1961, and since, especially in the year 1966, the largest peacetime armada in the history of mankind that I commented on repeatedly on this program was assembled to carry wheat to starving peoples in India, now our leaders have found that in spite of this depletion of national reserves in the United States, there is practically and factually at this moment a wider food gap in India than there was when the program to feed those starving millions began. That in spite of all the shipments of grain, conditions have actually gotten worse instead of better. That India in the meantime has been stricken by so-called natural calamities. That in the meantime, with all the sending of grain from the United States and other countries to India, destruction of existing foodstuffs has continued because of fantastic insect infestation, rodent damage, and the insistence of the populace there based upon various food taboos not to eat some of the vast foodstuffs readily available. For instance, the fact that India has a larger cattle herd, nationally speaking, than that of the United States. Fantastic, but true. But you see, those people don't eat meat, and the cattle share their grain. Now, the great surpluses of grains piled up by the United States and Canada have in the past provided a sort of a comfortable cushion for much of the rest of the world against crop failures and shortages. But now, the granaries of North America have been seriously depleted in the effort to avert famine around the world. And the running down of grain stocks means that the world is literally faced with a hand-to-mouth existence, said an editorial in the New York Times recently. Despite the great technological advances made in agriculture, avoidance of disaster over the next few years will depend almost entirely on the weather. Now, before I read that the other day, I was commenting on the almost difficult-to-understand belief on the part of so many back here about 4 or 5 years ago when the program to feed India began, that the United States reserves are inexhaustible We were operating under the assumption we could continue to feed hungry, starving millions of people around the world for almost time immemorial, that we could go on and on, and certainly no problems would strike the United States. Certainly we could depend upon good weather, and our crops would continue to be the best in the history of the nation. But now they're telling us that during the very time of the reports of some of these bizarre conditions, fantastic crop loss is expected in the winter crop, which, by the way, winter wheat in the United States is 80% of its total, which has already been in the ground. But now some of the blizzards and the snow and the freezing temperatures across much of the wheat belt of the United States has meant that that crop is at an absolute standstill and that much of it may never be harvested. We were going on the assumption all will be well, that we can depend upon good weather, good crops, and go right on and totally deplete our national resources and reserves to the point that today we're 170 million bushels under the emergency level in the United States. Now, leading weekly news magazines have been taking exception to the situation, reporting on it, but the average person seems totally out of touch with it. And so, again, I'm citing it on the World Tomorrow program for a very great reason. It's one of the biggest and most virtually insoluble problems in the world today. Every fresh study, said the New York Times, reaches the same grim conclusion. The world is on a treadmill when it comes to feeding the growing population of developing countries. It must run hard to stay in the same place, and just to stay in the same place will not head off starvation and chaos. The Times in London recently said the problem of the starving millions has been stated, overstated, and understated for many years. The next 24 to 28 years are going to be the most critical, said Dr. Binay Sen, Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. He gave this warning. If the rate of food production cannot be significantly increased, listen to these words, we must be prepared for the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, now, what if you could hear predictions of the greatest abundance in history, of the greatest food production, the greatest crop in the history of the world? What if you could hear predictions about such abundant, overflowing crops that industry would be hard-pressed to invent the new machinery to even harvest it fast enough? What if you could be assured by a grand master plan for peace and have absolute confidence in it that there would be a wonderful world of total disarmament, of peace all over the world, of one language, of total literacy and education for all? What if you could be assured there would be a world of an end to racial confusion and strife, of one world language, one world calendar, one world religion, one world government, of all of the vast and the dreamy slogans of mankind from time immemorial finally coming to pass, like a great society, a grand design, a new society, a new frontier, the achievement of the hopes and dreams and goals of humankind from the time Cain killed Abel, finally coming to pass? Well, I think most of us are so conditioned to the bad news, we'd say that's impossible. It's almost as if we like to believe the bad news, and the good news sounds too good to be true. Now, on the one hand, our leaders say that unless we achieve some world super government, in the words of Sir Winston Churchill, then the world is absolutely doomed. Frankly, most leaders expect the latter. It's just a matter of staving it off. They're not sure when. Many people sit back, such as Sir Bertrand Russell, and say they absolutely believe that mankind is doomed, and I think a lot of people act and live as if they partly believe it, as if they suspect there may be no good news for the world tomorrow, but that good news is available, of the solution to these fantastic problems that confront mankind right now today. It's about time you read that good news and heard it. I have a could-be newspaper in which you can read such headlines as Total Disarmament Achieved, A Complete Revolution in the Weather, an article about a new machine that is having to be invented to keep up with the fantastic planting that is coming right along the heels of the harvesting, to where, because of a minor accident between a tractor and a harvester, the one plowing and the other reaping, the one overtaking the other, that they had to invent a machine that would do it both at the same time. Articles about how people are taking unlearning courses to get out of their minds a lot of pagan superstitions, food taboos, and weird ideas and notions about anything from language, race, and religion to sociology and the humanities.
an article about total mental health instead of the 19 million Americans and fantastic numbers of Britons, Australians, South Africans, Canadians, Europeans, you name them, who are walking around a little bit nutty in the head. 19 million Americans and more today who are in serious need of so-called psychiatric care. A world of wall-to-wall people, a world of megalopolises stretching from coast to coast and inland, of the glittering jangle of jumbled trash piles and smoking heaps of rubble of asphalt, concrete, and glass that we call cities that are filled with crime and fear. Where you know as well as I, your wife, your daughter, or your son does not dare venture into certain parts of these big cities of ours, and where pollution of our air, our water, and our food continue apace with our degeneration of physical, moral, mental, and spiritual health. Where we are apparently not only populating or peopling ourselves off the earth, but we are polluting ourselves off the earth, and we stand ready to blast ourselves off the earth. And people fail to take account of the stark reality of these days. And therein is much of our problem. At a time when, as never before, we need to thoroughly apprehend all of the trends and conditions of humankind, our populaces are going to sleep. People I talked to in Britain couldn't care less. They have the idea, because they've read a Lord Hornblower novel of the type, that some great man from somewhere is going to come along like another Sir Winston Churchill at the last moment. We've always won in the ninth inning, haven't we? And rescue the British people from the fantastic national skids on which they find themselves today. A nice hope. A pleasant dream. But it's nothing more than a pipe dream. And the current trends and mathematical curves that you could absolutely, positively assess and practically prove to yourself will tell you otherwise. Britain's sun has set. Unpleasant news for many people, but the absolute truth. Now, at a time in the United States when we need imagination, when we need the truth, when we need good news, and we need to evaluate this master plan for peace and to see into the age beyond and to see instead of wall-to-wall people and see instead of people populating themselves off the earth and see instead of fantastic food wars fought by massive populations over the dwindling means for survival, see instead of proliferation of nuclear weapons and more than 40 nations in the atomic club and maybe next year Red China with the hydrogen bomb, we need to be able to see peace. And one world government, and one language, and a new calendar, and people cooperating. We need to be able to see, practically and tangibly, the solutions to the world's ills today, but we don't see them, do we? And we don't even want to see the problems. How are we ever going to see the solutions when we won't admit the problems are real? Recently, matter of fact, in January, CBS TV aired an hour-long national current events quiz. It was simple. It was simple. I saw this thing, and the questions weren't all that difficult. About 33 of them were a little bit tricky. But by far, the majority of them were easily answered by anybody about halfway up on the news, and that means glancing at the front page of his newspapers and hearing maybe one or two news broadcasts a week. For instance, here was a picture of Mao Tse-tung, the picture of this guy who's been in every national magazine you can imagine. Remember them swimming in the river? And the question was, who is the Communist Party boss in Red China? Was it Mao Tse-tung, Ho Chi Minh, or Chiang Kai-shek? The average grade in a national sample was 48. As a nation, we have flunked wading pool and sand pile in current events tests. Americans tend to be isolationists almost by nature. We like to convince ourselves that no problem will come nigh our dwelling, that all will be well. Here we are, giving away Panama, as I said when I was on the spot years ago. As a matter of fact, when I was first there in 1954, I wrote an article in the magazine called The Plain Truth. It is a unique magazine that talked about the eventuality of the United States losing Panama. Right now, at this precise moment, secret negotiations are underway to give it away. One of the most vital strategic sea lanes on the face of the earth, linking the biggest industrial and military power on the face of the earth together. And yet, here's a little tiny nation about the size of a couple of our large cities put together that has the United States giant, the so-called elephant to the north, geopolitically speaking, trembling in fear. It's amazing. It's amazing, this non-existent idea of world public opinion that makes us Mr. Fear. Well, there was a prophecy that said the pride of our power would be broken, and it has been. So at the very time when we need as never before, correct appraisal of world trends and conditions and a real deep understanding of them and a willingness to investigate the future, we have people playing hide-and-go-seek, trying to seek pleasures and hide their eyes from reality, and a national televised questionnaire proves it. The average grade was 48, flunk, on simple, up-to-the-moment news items. Now, if you want to hear some good news, write for a booklet that's jam-packed with it, entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. I have it right here before me on the studio desk. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And as well, inside this booklet that tells you that there is a great master plan for peace, that there are solutions to the world's ills, is a could-be newspaper with these articles I have mentioned that tell you, instead of all the bad news and the gloomy predictions about mass starvation, nuclear war, extinction of humankind, it foretells the truth of the news in advance, the news your children and grandchildren will be reading. News before it happens, the best news you've ever read. Of the late 70s, the early 80s and 90s, the 2000s. Factual news, news that not only could be true, but will be true. This booklet is different because it dares to face squarely the conditions of the world the way they really are. But then it also dares to accept the great master plan for the future, which are found in the pages of the Bible. Now, you're all aware of the Bible. Many of us hear it quoted. We may know presidents revere it. We may hear politicians refer to it. Brides carry it. Drawers in hotels and motels have it. Reading racks in airplanes and trains have it. It's bought and sold. It's written about. It's maligned and harangued over. It's argued over. It's a consistent bestseller. Almost everybody owns one. We're familiar with it. At the same time, however, it's the world's most ignored book. It's a book of controversy, a book of mystery, a book of superstition and suspicion, a book over which thousands of arguments have begun and practically none have been finished, a book about which people have positive opinions and know very little. One man arbitrarily accuses it of being a lie, a hoax. Another says part of it is true. One says it's history. Another says it's poetry. Somebody else says it's Jewish tradition. Some say you ought to accept only one third of it. Some say only the Old Testament. Some say I'll take the epistles of Paul. Some say read it for inspiration, others say read it to understand it, and still others claim you can't understand it. But how many people, if any, realize that the Bible is the master plan for peace in the age beyond, and that one-third of the Bible is prophecy, and that most of that prophecy is right now beginning to be fulfilled and is yet to be fulfilled in our day? How many people realize that? A tiny handful. 0.003 or some odd percent of the population of the earth, that's how many. Now, you know, at funeral services, when we're suddenly brought up short by a tragedy in the family, when we have that grave, sobering moment of deep, perplexed wonderment, that time of reflection, sorrowful, agonized doubt and fear, that time of melancholy memories, we may hear reference, if we're listening, in the soft intonations of the minister, to a resurrection. Somebody may talk about a resurrection of the dead. All through the New Testament, Jesus Christ talked about a resurrection, of course, but nobody believes him. Paul, Peter, all of them spoke of it. It's called the whole goal, the hope of the Christian. It's the goal toward which Paul said he pressed. It was the whole goal of his life. He was inspired to say that living human beings can be changed instantaneously at the same precise instant as this great resurrection is predicted to occur. But now, this sounds weird. People won't believe that. But then, of course, some people don't even believe the world is round. Now, imagine this scene, if you can. It's society night, and everybody who is anybody is coming to the huge civic auditorium, the big music center, and outside, the Cadillacs and the Rolls Royces and all the big limousines are pulling up, and bejeweled and befurred ladies, portly gentlemen with their tuxedos, are getting out of the limousines and coming into this fantastic big auditorium. It's a glittering, glamorous, fantastically wealthy crowd this December as people gather together to hear again the world-famous stirring melodies of George Friedrich Handel's The Messiah. A performance of one of the most delightful pieces of music ever written, The Messiah, the world-famous, much-beloved oratorio that tells about the birth and the nativity of Christ, but also tells about the resurrection, about a world government. It's amazing to me. I've sung the bass part of The Messiah, and my favorite is this stirring number, The Trumpet Shall Sound, one that is usually placed near the end of the Messiah performance. But does anybody ever pay attention to the words of this music? The whole score of The Messiah, if you were to just read it instead of listen to it, tells you the entire master plan for future peace. It portrays the coming king of the earth. It dares to talk before these bespectacled, powdered, and corseted people of the resurrection of the dead. And they sit and listen and thrill to the music, but they pay absolutely no attention to the words. There's one moving choral number that talks of how, since by man came death, by man also comes the resurrection of the dead. Then comes the trumpet, and the words go, the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. And from the time when it was first written and first performed before the King of England, glittering crowds of nobility, tycoons of business and industry, leaders of government and the military have sat in awed silence and thrill to the massive, swelling, exalting, moving feeling of The Messiah by George Friedrich Handel, without understanding a word that was said. Isn't that amazing? It's part and parcel of modern society. There's nothing embarrassing about going to see The Messiah. You can go to see it without even admitting that you believe a word of it. And then somebody like us not is going to come on the stage the next day and sing the song that everybody applauds. It ain't necessarily so. Talking, of course, about the Bible. What a pack of hypocrites some of us are. At one moment we're applauding the words of the Bible and tears come to our eyes and we say that's fantastic and that's wonderful. At one moment we see former President Kennedy had a Bible on his desk and Mr. Johnson is quoting it and saying we may be living in the very times of which one man said, choose life. At one moment, we hear that a lawyer uses the Bible to prepare court cases. At the next moment, we say the Bible is a pack of lies and God is dead and we believe in new morality and we ought to water down the law and let criminals out of jail and go by a double standard of lie as long as nobody catches you and steal when nobody's looking and divorce two or three times because, after all, who's hurt? Now, what does the resurrection have to do with the world tomorrow? It has everything to do with it. The whole hope of a Christian. Let me tell you about a couple of scriptures that portray the whole hope of a Christian that few people have ever read. This is an amazing thing. But in the Bible, in the last book of the Bible, the apocalypse that this one world leader referred to, Dr. Bene Sen, when he said the four horsemen of the apocalypse may be ahead for us, he was talking of the sixth chapter of this same book of Revelation. But in the second chapter, and verse 26, is a promise. And in the third chapter, in verse 21, that same promise repeated. Here is the whole hope, the whole purpose of life that is set forth in this book. But let's see if we can believe it literally. Jesus Christ of Nazareth said in verse 26 of Revelation 2, and he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. Now that says nations, plural. And it goes on to say, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, government taken out of the hands of man and given into the hands of God. Government from a divine, all-wise, all-powerful source. One world government, which, as if with one voice, world leaders say we must have, and at the same time admit that mankind cannot bring it about. Yet here's the whole solution. There is that painful alternative that people don't want to face. That there is a God, that God does exist and does live, that he is a one spirit being, a personality in a specific place with a son that sits beside him, that there is a great plan that is mapped out in the Bible, that humankind was put on the earth. It didn't happen by accident. It didn't climb from slime. It didn't evolve or come from scum. That we're not the result of a lot of beasts and birds flittering through the trees. We didn't come from monkeys or amino acids or anything else. But that God Almighty and his existence can be proved, and his word can be proved, unless a person is a spiritual coward, unless he is, as the Bible says, an absolute fool, he believes it. and he knows that God exists, and the Bible says anybody who says otherwise in his heart is a fool. Now, hanging upside down in a well, adrift in the broad expanse of the Pacific Ocean in a one-man life raft, people pray. Sitting in the comfort of their own living room, in front of their television, well-fed, overstuffed, and maybe with their after-dinner cigar. People don't believe in God. Today, we have a new age, the age of cynicism, the age of hyper-acidic, carping cynicism, of griping and complaining, the sick joke, and the caustic criticism of everything that smacks of permanence, of stability, of morality, of ethics, mores, and laws, and especially anything that has to do with God and His Word. And you can hear all the talk programs where people like to discuss the empty-headed arguments and the harebrained idiocy of some darkened and demented minds that haven't got the sense to evaluate a traffic ticket, let alone to really tell you what the trends and conditions of this world mean and where we're going. And people like to do nothing more than sit back today and argue and harangue and trade opinions. And in so doing, think smugly, they're coming up with some little bit of truth. Thy word is truth, said Jesus Christ. The word of God is truth, and anyone who is not a spiritual coward can prove it to himself. You need to write for these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible. Unless you are a spiritual coward, and if you are, then admit it. If you're afraid you might find your God exists, then admit it, but if you're not, write for the booklets. Make up your own mind to yourself. I don't know who you are, and vice versa. Maybe this is one of those sort of turn the radio down lower programs where if you're sitting in a drive-in, you're liable to be a little embarrassed about now. I won't apologize. That's your problem. If you want to prove what kind of a society it is, take a Bible and tuck it under your arm and get on a bus. I hope you escape the funny farm. That's just about how far we are away from God Almighty and His Word, His prophecies, and His laws. We're so ashamed of His Word, we're so ashamed to admit we believe in Him, we're so ashamed to admit we might pray to Him, that we don't even want to talk about Him, let alone hear about Him. Well, this booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, tells you how great world government was planned from the beginning. And it dares to talk about the resurrection and to tell you, furthermore, where these individuals mentioned in the Bible are going to be. Here are chapters in the Bible that tell you plainly that David is going to stand on this earth. Here are chapters in the Bible that define Job and Noah and Elijah and men of old in specific jobs and positions in a world-ruling government. Here's the whole hope of a Christian portrayed in Revelation 2:26 and 3:21, where in the third chapter, the 21st verse, it says, To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. Why don't more people believe it? It's the whole hope of life. Write for this book that is free of charge, and of course no one's going to call on you. There's no price. And also the ones I've mentioned on Does God Exist and the Proof of the Bible. But the book that The Wonderful World Tomorrow, by the title of this program, will come by return mail free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. There is no price. No one's trying to make you join anything. Nobody's going to call on you. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.